chick flicks, romantic comedies, rom-coms. You love them, you hate them.
But we are here to eviscerate them. Welcome to the Rom-Com Killjoys podcast.
We are your hosts, Eliza Bertram
and Janelle Walker. Now, let's get on with some feminist joy killing.
My viewing notes for this week's movie read, Prince becomes king. Bad acting. Fishy? And that's it. I didn't feel any more detail was necessary. Perhaps I was inspired by our intrepid sneaker-clad protagonist, Amber, the woman who would be queen. That's right, listeners, we are back at it with the second installment of the Christmas Prince saga, The Royal Wedding!
I feel like I have to say that once again, having just watched the first Christmas Prince for the first time back in July, I was once again startled that our protagonist's name is Amber. And I don't know why, but every time they refer to her as Amber, I just keep thinking, that can't possibly be her name.
Well, it doesn't help that in this one, she's about to marry the king, and yet no one in the palace seems to have any official protocol for how they're supposed to refer to her. She's Amber, she's Miss Amber, she's Lady Amber, she's the future queen, she's the queen-to-be.
Oh.
But speaking Amber. Of names, we have a very important one to say right now, because we are once again joined by one of our absolute favorite guests. It's Alice!
Hello. Contain your excitement, everyone.
Alice is here reporting as our chief wedding correspondent.
Yes, thank you. I had no idea I had an actual title, but I'm official now.
Far more official than Queen Amber.
It's funny that you mentioned that, because I did keep thinking throughout the movie, now what is her damn name? I was like, Allison, Alexandria, no, that's not it. Amber? That's not right.
You could tell me her name was anything and I'd probably believe you. If you were like, it's Caitlin or it's Charlize, I'd be like, sure, maybe, I don't know.
We're talking about Christmas Prince 2, A Royal Wedding this week. Ooh, and here is your substantial Google summary to kick us off. A year after Amber, played by Rose McIver, helped King Richard, played by Ben Lamb, secure the crown, the two are set to tie the knot in a royal Christmas wedding. But their plans are jeopardized when Amber finds herself second-guessing whether or not she's cut out to be queen. Well,
uh-oh.
That's what Google says that Christmas Prince, A Royal Wedding is about. But my friends, what is it really about?
I can tell you what it's about. So this movie is about a low-rent Grace Kelly who marries an off-brand prince of a Christmas dystopia version of Monaco. And it all goes wrong. The end.
Yeah, that's the whole thing.
Alice, you're so right. I couldn't stop thinking about Grace Kelly in this movie as well, funnily enough.
God,
like, I
yes.
kept, like, Googling the history of that because I kept thinking, like, oh, yeah, like, who's another famous working woman who, American, who moved into a royal family and then had to give up her entire illustrious career? Beautiful Grace Kelly.
By working woman, you mean an acclaimed actress that was so elegant and classy before she married royalty that the American newspapers routinely refer to her as Lady Grace, then yes.
Yeah, no, we do surprisingly have a couple of examples that you can juxtapose with the story here and this kind of classic story of like an American girl marries a prince. It has actually happened a few times. Unsurprisingly, it's frequently an actress, so someone who's sort of in the upper echelons of society and might be interacting with royalty in a way that your normal blogger wouldn't. But there are a few examples that we can look at of like what it was like to go from being either a completely private figure or a public figure but who had control of their own image to being a member of a royal family, which is quite a process.
Right. I think the one that comes to mind most is that I actually checked the dates on this, and the Christmas Prince movies basically track the progression of Meghan Markle and Prince Harry's mm-hmm. relationship. The first movie came out not long after they were engaged. The second movie came out not long after they married. And the third movie came out not long after they had their first baby, Archie. So are these movies about Meghan Markle? No, they're not. They would be more interesting if they were. But they do bring up these interesting questions about an American who presumably, the film, I guess, presumes, and we're supposed to presume too, comes from a land where aristocracy doesn't exist, has to find her way in an aristocratic society. Whoa, whoa, whoa. What's going to happen?
What's so funny to me about the way that they try to tackle this topic in this movie particularly, because the sort of big crux of this movie is Amber learning how to let go of her sort of private persona in order to be a part of the family, whereas the first movie is about her falling in love. But in this movie, they both try to address the how do you go from being like a poor private figure to a rich public figure, you know, that kind of like, but I'm just a normal girl and now I'm like part of this big wealthy family. And they try to track the Meghan Markle sort of thing of like, how do you leave your in the public eye career behind for a different kind of in the public eye career? And in trying to do both of those stories, they do justice to neither of them. Because, you know, there was a lot written around the time of Meghan Markle's wedding to Prince Harry about her having to, like, delete all of her social media and give up her acting career and all this kind of stuff. But that wasn't just, like, she wasn't allowed to have a Facebook. It was that she had a public brand already, and she needed to transition that to a different kind of public brand. Whereas in this movie, you get Amber being like, but I have a blog that a few hundred people read. And then being like, they won't let me keep my blog anymore. Now I have nothing to do. Like, no, now you're going to be running, you know, like the social media for the palace or whatever, right? There's other tasks that come in to replace those things. It's not just that you can't be yourself.
I have to say, it feels oddly like a 90s movie because who keeps a blog anymore? This was written, like, in a time capsule from the past and, like, sent forward. But yeah, like, you know, this movie is, it weirdly makes Amber seem selfish because she's trying to create a brand around her marrying the prince of the king of Aldovia. And that's not okay for a royal to do, you know?
Right.
Like, you create a brand in conjunction with the palace and whatever their PR process is, which apparently in Aldovia is next to nothing, which is odd for a a country where apparently the monarchy still has power. And sets the political agenda, and the palace has no game plan for anything, no game plan for people marrying in, the individuals in the royal family, you know, basic financing, but I guess we'll get to that plot. I hope you guys can hear my finger quotes. I'm trying to make them audible. Plot. But yeah, well, I guess we'll get to that later. It feels low picking on this movie for these things that don't make any sense because, I mean, for God's sakes, they put Amber in the same fucking outfit every single time she appears. She's engaged to the king of the country, a king that still has monarchical powers. He is a powerful political figure, and she shows up to events in like some horrible H&M dress, you know, like it's not fair. It's like picking on the smallest kid in the playground. Like this movie is a kindergartner and I'm a high school student and I'm beating the fuck out of it. But I guess you're going to we're just going to keep kicking that 6-year-old.
We are. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's a plot line in this movie about a like, you know, school play that seems to be like a middle school very low quality production play. And when you're watching that, you're like, this seems like the same level of production quality as the entire movie. So I don't understand what's happening here. The whole movie is so cheaply made, which is like wild because it's coming from Netflix, right? Like we're talking about the same company that managed to fund The Crown. And everyone is in clothes that like aren't fitted well to them, that look like they were bought at Macy's. They're, you know, they have all of these like Christmas party evenings where it's literally the like 8 named characters standing in a small room holding glasses. There's no like background actors milling about. There's no servers walking through. There's no like table covered in food. I mean, the amount of money that wasn't spent on this movie is visible.
But the thing that always unsettles me about this now a series, since God help me, I've seen 2 of them now, is that that's clearly like a distinct aesthetic choice that they have made. Mm-hmm. which is unsettling in its accuracy. Like, they're able to capture the experience of watching something that is low budget so well on purpose, which is really difficult to do without seeming like you're doing kitsch, because this is not kitsch. This is not camp. This is just bad for the sake of bad.
Right.
But I also want to talk about that school play scene, because there's so much going on there. I mean, first of all, this movie cements for me, I think, and I want to hear what you all think about this. My sense now about Aldovia is that, as Alice said, it's like a fourth-rate principality theocratic dictatorship that's run by a royal family whose religion is Christmas, is what I get.
Correct. What's your question?
I guess my question is like, is the school play their nativity play? Like, is the whole thing about the Christmas ogre like their version of a nativity play? Like,
yeah, that how deep are we getting about the Christmas ogre appears to be like their central folklore. Like, it's about Christmas. You can look at cultures all around the world and their central folktale, like their national epic, very rarely has anything to do with Christmas. But I guess that is besides the point. Do we want to run over like a basic summary of the plot?
Right. I guess we should address the, you know, I said what this movie is about Amber becoming a part of the royal family, which is what it's about. But
sort of
what the plot is actually that the country is having some severe economic troubles, and the newly crowned king is trying to push through a new economic plan that will bring money into the country by paying construction companies to build buildings. Unclear where the monarchy is getting the money that they're paying the construction companies for, but whatever, that's the idea here, except that it doesn't seem to be working. And Amber is the only one who thinks that there's something suspicious about that. Everyone else is just like, that's the economy. And so they have to solve this problem. And over the course of the movie, there's a workers' strike, which seems to include all workers, from construction workers to the high school theater staff.
Listen, it's a small country. There's only like 200 workers and they all go to the same pub.
There's, you know, a guy writes a letter to the royal family saying Merry Christmas to you, but I lost my job. And Amber instinctually knows that this man will have the inside information about where the internal funds for these construction projects are going, even though he's just like a regular construction worker who lost his job.
And throughout it all, Amber has to plan her wedding and try to assert her own personality and taste onto every aspect of her hastily planned Christmas wedding.
Right, which they've known about for a year, but have not planned over the course of the past year.
And is being planned by Sahil, who is, I don't know if he's the best character or the worst character in the film. He's definitely like a racist stereotype, but I don't know if that takes away from him being somehow the best character in the movie.
Yeah, he is always wearing vaguely Indian-inspired outfits and referring to himself in the third person as in Zaheel's greatest creation. And it's a very bizarre affect, I must say.
Yeah, he's definitely offensive from a racial and a sexuality standpoint. Like, he's both a weird Indian stereotype and a weird gay stereotype and just like a badly written and badly acted part. So there's a lot happening there to be concerned about.
And he's introduced by stealing a cab.
Am I wrong? Am I misremembering? Didn't Amber get her cab stolen in the first movie? Yeah, the prince.
I think it's supposed to be a callback. Like, every time Amber comes to the airport, someone steals a cab, which is a weird thing to call back.
But this time, her cab wasn't stolen. Her dad's cab was stolen, which by romantic comedy rules means that her dad and Zaheel must get together.
You're so
wow,
right,
where's
Alice.
That fan fiction?
Yes.
Oh my god, why didn't I even think about that? That's actually what happens in the next movie. Spoiler alert.
Damn it.
No, but it also, like, and again, Amber's at the airport about to go to the palace where she's going to be the queen, and she doesn't think that they're going to send a car for her. I mean, I think actually, let's address this. Because watching this movie this time around, I've seen it once before, and I just kept being struck by how little faith in the intelligence of the movie's viewers the movie seems to have. Like, the writers and the director really seem to believe that the people watching this are so unbelievably dumb that if something does not happen on screen spelled out like you were explaining it to a kindergartner, you won't understand what happened. And so even though they start at the beginning by having Amber say, we've been engaged for a year and we've been going back and forth between Aldovia and New York to visit each other, everything that one would learn about living with their fiance's parents or home or culture over the course of that year, she only begins to learn here when she comes for Christmas and the wedding. So she like shows up to the airport and isn't expecting them to send her a car. Are we supposed to believe that they haven't sent her a car the other six times she's flown to the country? She like doesn't know any of the protocol. Are we supposed to believe that she hasn't been at the palace learning the protocol over the last year? Like there's all these things that would not be difficult to understand if they just moved right past it, but they don't seem to believe that we will comprehend it unless it's like glaringly obvious.
Yeah, and it kind of adds to your lack of sympathy for Amber because she's about to be queen of this very small nation and apparently married to its ruling power. I still can't get over it. And she hasn't bothered to do any research into the customs, the folklore, the basic culture of Aldovia, insofar as the culture extends beyond Christmas.
Well, and even then, like, she doesn't know how they decorate for Christmas, even though she was there last year at Christmas. She doesn't know any of their customs around Christmas, even though theoretically she's been planning a Christmas wedding for a year. What has she been doing for the last year?
Writing her blog.
Blogging about how she's still Amber, despite it all.
I also want to talk a little bit about the whole worker strike part of the plot, because I notice, and I, you know, you can't miss me with this, Netflix. I noticed that they very conveniently left the whole like political and economic unrest part of the plot out of the summary. and I think that's because if you watch this film from a certain vantage point, the tagline could be, the workers ruin Christmas. Like, basically, Princess Emily's school play has to be postponed because the workers are striking and they're ruining Christmas and they have to do their Christmas play at the palace, la la la. So I guess what I'm wondering is, like, if we were to take, you know, like a Marxist analysis of Christmas Prince 2, like, what would we say it's trying to say about the workers and the ruling class?
Listen, the royal family in this story literally still has the divine right to rule.
Well, but do they have divine right to rule? Because didn't we establish in the first movie that he's adopted?
But like, what even is divine right to rule if your religion is Christmas? This is also a big question for me.
You are the most Christmassy in all the land.
There's definitely, you know, Amber like saves the day at the end by caring about the people, except that they also go out of their way to continually remind you that the rest of the royal family also cares about the people, but are just, I guess, like out of touch enough that they can't figure out how to fix this problem. But they fix the problem just by, like, finding the one guy who was funneling some money out of the country and putting him in the dungeon. And then, like, the problem is fixed. So clearly this economy operates on a very simple system where it can literally be flipped with a switch to suddenly be a strong and powerful economy again.
I am telling you guys, it runs on Christmas. Okay, do you want me to break it down for you?
Yes.
Please do.
Okay. The movie constantly hammers home how money is leaving the country, wages aren't getting paid, there's stagnation, people don't have money, and it is constantly mentioned along with the lack of the tree in the courtyard. The workers go on strike, and the first thing Emily tells Amber is that, but there's no Christmas tree in the courtyard. And that's a vital part of Aldovan customs. And it's not Christmas unless there's a Christmas tree in the courtyard. So the strike results in no Christmas play, which lowers the Christmas spirits. And meanwhile, the Christmas spirits are even low to begin with because there's no Christmas tree in the courtyard. And that's woven in throughout the dialogue with the stagnation and the lack of the Christmas tree. So the next thing Amber does is she and, like, random prince goes and gets a tree. Like, they chop it down, they set it up, it starts snowing in, like, a beautiful white Christmas thing. They go tobogganing, and that is the beginning of the process of Cousin Simon, who apparently has an economics degree, coming back and beginning to help crack the case They are at a Christmas party when they receive a tip that helps them further solve the mystery. And then at the end, they figure it out and light the Christmas tree, and they have Christmas again. Like, they could have solved the economic mystery if they had just gone full barrel ahead with Christmas. That's the moral of the story, because you see in the beginning of the movie, the prince, Christmas prince, he keeps ignoring Amber and his promise to go cut down a Christmas tree together because they have important meetings with the prime minister and solving the economy. If he had skipped all of those meetings and gone to cut down the Christmas tree, it would have been solved a lot faster.
Wow.
Yeah, because as soon as he stops going to meetings and goes with Amber to cut down a Christmas tree, the problems in the economy start resolving themselves.
So here's my question. Does that mean then that, like, there's a meta-text going on here? And now I'm just, like, trying to add meaning to this movie that's vacuous, and I'm so sorry to everyone involved. But it could be that this is a meta-text that's, like, propaganda for Aldovia, where it's, like, at the end of the day, the thing that matters the most is our state religion, Christmas. Adhere to the state religion, and everybody at the end, which actually happens in the plot, everyone, everybody at the end is going to get their money and their Christmas bonus as long as they believe in the spirit of the season.
Yeah.
Which I guess is Aldovia's main export, based on what you're saying?
Yes. Christmas is Aldovia's religion, its export, it's also its import, its main holiday, its national epic. Did I miss something? It runs everything. It is the state religion, it is the state economy, and it is the state government. It all runs on Christmas.
Well, you know, it's interesting because I think that a lot of Christmas movies do, in fact, run on Christmas magic, but generally are more upfront about it, whereas this operates like one where, like, magic is more of a sort of ethereal, like, permeating thing as opposed to, like, an actual act of magic. But if you watch, like, the Santa Claus, the closer they get to Christmas, the more magical powers Santa has, right? Like, there are movies where Christmas is an actual magical element. And this movie is written like a sort of down-home Christian, like, Christmas brings a magic that's indescribable, but it actually functions as a Santa movie where Christmas has a literal magical ability that grants wishes by the end of the movie.
But it's also weird because it's not like, I mean, throwing back to our Night Before Christmas episode, there's actually something kind of medieval about this film's, like, dramaturgy, because it's saying that, like, Christmas magic is magic, but it's also the material reality of our economy, which usually those things don't go together in traditional Christmas movies. So maybe what we're stumbling upon is that the Christmas Prince series is a kind of unique world-building scenario for a Christmas rom-com, in the sense that it just goes so all in on Christmas that that nothing escapes from its void. Pretty much.
Well, and I also think by that standard that Amber, this queen-to-be, fits into a more sort of dystopian protagonist role, in that she is oddly, perfectly made to survive in this dystopian Christmas world, but is resistant to it in this movie, right? Like, she's trying to exist in the old world that she came from, which is less dystopian than this, but now that she's here, she realizes she actually has the particular set of traits that allow her to operate successfully within this strange world and try to improve upon it. But she's fighting that. And we haven't even gotten to the end of the saga, so we don't know if she's going to be successful or not.
Is her baby going to destroy this Christmas dystopia? Stay tuned.
I feel like the next one's going to be like the third Hunger Games movie, you know?
I think that leads us to an important topic, which, you know, it's funny. This film calls itself Christmas Prince, The Royal Wedding, but the wedding part is, like, literally the last 10 minutes, which I found extremely disappointing. But I think that in the spirit of what Alice was saying, like, beating up on the six-year-old on the playground, I just feel like now is the time for us to be, in the spirit of Christmas, extremely petty about this wedding.
Yeah, so I guess with the Christmas wedding, they're doing kind of a standard plot where, like, you know, everyone has an opinion on every aspect of the wedding, and Amber doesn't feel like the wedding is about her and for her, and, like, nothing that she prefers is getting taken into account, and she's just being browbeaten, and, you know, it's against the spirit of Christmas, you guys. So to that end, they've brought in this aforementioned Zahil, the wedding planner, who uses words like utkatur, he pronounces it incorrectly, but and like avant-garde to describe his vision, and yet somehow in the same breath it is also described as being the historic or traditional choice. It's very strange what they're trying to do with Zahil the wedding planner, because like all of the dialogue is like, oh, this is like tradition, you don't want to break tradition, do you? But meanwhile Zahil is like there with his like coterie of like black clad, brightly hair colored art students buzzing around making like experimental gowns. What I thought is, because all of her scenes where she's trying to plan the wedding, she's trying to say like, well, actually I prefer a wedding dress that looked more like what Grace Kelly wore in her marriage to the Prince of Monaco. There's this woman, I guess the only person who works in the palace who is cognizant of protocol. I don't know her name or her title. She's protocol lady.
Protocol lady.
And she keeps saying, like, this is protocol. This is historic. You must wear the crown jewels. You must wear, like, a version of the Queen Mother's dress to walk down the aisle, like, blah, 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 protocol, 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 tradition, tradition, tradition. Meanwhile, her fiancé is trying to hammer through a modernization protocol for the country of Aldovia, which is being met with harsh resistance. So I kept expecting these two plot lines to meet somewhere, where it was revealed that protocol lady is part of a faction of hardcore old guard traditionalists who are sabotaging the modernization effort by funneling away the money and doing other acts of sabotage. And meanwhile, they are keeping Amber, the journalist, who, like, come on, in the first movie, we saw what kind of journalism she was doing. She was doing gossip journalism under false pretenses. But anyway, let's all pretend she's like a keen, like battle-hardened journalist. They're all distracting her by making her wedding planning as horrible as possible so that she doesn't sniff out their plot with her incredible journalistic instincts. And I thought that was what the plot was going to be, but I guess that was too complicated. It required some actual writing instead of introducing a character two-thirds of the way through the movie and then revealing him to be the guy stealing all the money. So I don't know, that's just where I thought it was gonna go. I think my expectations for that were a little too high, so I apologize to the movie, I apologize to Christmas Prince 2. Shouldn't have put all of those expectations on it.
I mean, I have to agree with you. I also, there's a moment where they skirt accidentally almost into that kind of a plot and then immediately just bypass it, because at some point when she's complaining to her fiance, the king, whose name doesn't matter, saying, you know, and protocol lady keeps forcing me to do all these things I don't want to do, and this isn't going to be our wedding, and yada yada yada, and you know, and I want to focus on the economy and she won't let me, and he sort of asks her, like, do you think she's trying to sabotage us? And she's like, no, I do think that she's just genuinely cares about, like, traditions and protocol. And then they just move on. And I was, like, in that moment thinking, oh, maybe she's working with the, like, creepy uncle who's definitely fucking up the economy, who at this point, like, we've met and it's so clear he's going to be the bad guy. And I'm like, maybe she's secretly working with him, or at least maybe they're part of the same faction that, like, you know, wants the traditional way rather than the push for modernization, or, you know, or whatever. And that's not it. She's just sort of a cranky old lady who cares about tradition, and no one's ever told her that tradition doesn't matter anymore. Okay. And then on top of that, and again, this goes back to that the movie's sort of lack of respect for its own viewers and our ability to think for ourselves. You know, they keep having Amber say, I'm different and I'm not like, you know, anything the monarchy's seen before, and I want to do things my way, and I want to wear a wedding dress that reflects me. And then, like, her wedding dress looks like a combination of Grace Kelly, Meghan Markle, and Kate Middleton's wedding dresses, which were all sort of based on the same type of design, right? That, like, sleek but classic, relatively high neck, you know, long-sleeved, lace and satin, right? Like, very traditional sort of, this is an acceptable way to be a modern princess look. and that's exactly what she wears to the wedding. You know, all these things where they're like, oh, you'll think that this is just Amber being Amber, and it just looks like the cheap school theater version of every wedding, every royal wedding that the people who are going to watch this movie have watched. Like, do they think that anyone who's tuning in for this movie a month after Meghan Markle's wedding didn't also watch Meghan Markle's wedding? Like, we're not going to compare the two.
Like, that's why I think the encapsulation of the movie's whole, like, feeling and final note about modernization versus tradition is that underneath that dress, which is clearly so traditional and so of the classic Americans marrying British monarchs or a European monarch's school, is that she shows us her little chucks underneath. She's got her gold sneakers underneath. So don't worry, everybody. She's traditional on top, but she's still a party Amber on the bottom, which is perfect for this movie, because essentially the note that they end on is like, no. Monarchies are super chill. Tradition is great. But, like, modernization is fine, but, like, we really need this tradition, though, and monarchies are good.
Yeah, there is something really discordant about the king, Christmas king, pushing his modernization initiative and defending it at every turn. Yet this movie, I mean, it basically rests its laurels on tradition. They live in this big old castle that literally, it turns out, has a dungeon. They have these, like, Christmas parties, and it's all decked out in a traditional Christmas style with a Christmas tree and a roaring fire. And it's enmeshed in tradition. We don't see a genuinely modern aspect of the country ever.
Yeah, they have striking workers meeting in pubs like it's the mid-19th century. It's very interesting.
Well, and again, you know, they keep saying that this king, this young king, is pushing for this modernization initiative, but you don't see him pushing for any modernization of the monarchy itself. And if you look at the, you know, real-life European monarchies that we have to compare this to, the younger generation, which at this point let's call just sort of anyone under, like, 40, is in the places where they are trying to be a more modern monarchical presence, trying to also modernize their own image and their way that they interact with the people, whether that's Harry and William, or I know there's a couple of younger royals in like Sweden and Norway and stuff who, you know, have given up a lot of the larger palaces, or, you know, have spouses who have actual jobs, like out in the workforce, or, you know, who are doing these sort of things to try to modernize their own interactions with their people. And, like, there's a number of examples of that that you can look at in the real world. And then this fictional example, he's done nothing to modernize the monarchy. He's, you know, and he's given this opportunity of, like, a wedding to an outsider, to an American, to a, you know, someone with an internet presence. You're a young king who has his entire, you know, reign ahead of him. This would be the moment to, like, bring in some modern touches, which he doesn't do at all until Amber's like, you know, oh, my friends brought a DJ to our wedding. We're modern now.
Yes, I think the writers had an insurmountable challenge that it's really hard to modernize a monarchy when you have already established that they have a totalitarian Christmas dictatorship. And I don't know, like, if you're not going to challenge the Christmas dictatorship, like, you just kind of have to, like, throw some tinsel on it, I think. I also just want to say, because I have many, you know, the wedding is such a small part of the movie, but I just want to say that I really hope that sad and mournful Spanish guitar and the mother of the groom walking down the aisle in black is part of the Aldovian tradition at weddings, because that shit was inexplicable within the world of this Christmas dictatorship, and I have so many questions.
I watch it and, like, there's nothing here. It's a, like, it's the most basic bitch Christmas wedding I've ever seen in my life.
They didn't even fill the fucking church. Like, I'm sorry. I know that you have it in a smaller setting because you can't actually rent out, like, Westminster Abbey. But are you really going to tell me that they couldn't have gotten enough extras
to fill every pew? It's a small country, Eliza. It's a very fucking small country.
Yeah, I feel like one of the things about Aldovia that's really weird is, like, sometimes it just feels like a low-rent corporation. Like someone started a shell corp, and then they went too far with it and started telling people that it was, like, a 100-year-old, like, monarchy that came about during the, like, or Holy Roman Empire or some shit. and now they're just too caught up, so they have to keep lying and they have to keep covering their tracks, and now Richard's the head of it and he has no idea what's going on. All he knows how to do is Christmas. It's actually a tragedy if you think about
it. Maybe this is why people are against modernization. Like, everyone there is, like, a billionaire and doesn't want, like, modernization to ruin their bag somehow. I'm just trying to figure this out. I don't know.
That's the most sensible thing I've heard.
Well, and that explains why the random construction worker also knew all about which shell corporations were funding all of this, is because he's actually one of the, like, CEOs of these construction companies, but he's hiding out in Aldovia pretending to be simple construction foreman.
Are the buildings going up? That's what I want to know. Are the buildings physically, is the infrastructure being structured? That's the only thing that they specifically mentioned in their modernization initiative. I assume there's other things, maybe. But, you know, infrastructure. They said multiple times that they're specifically building infrastructure. Where is it? Are the bridges being built? Like, where are they?
Well, and I definitely get, like, a, dare I say it, Trumpian vibe of they're, like, building these things, but not necessarily running them, right? Like, they're like, we're going to build schools and hospitals and important office buildings, and then they'll just remain empty. But, like, they'll have, you know, Royal Family of Aldovia written on the top, so it'll look impressive.
Yeah, as Amber wrote down in her little reporter's notebook, it's fishy. I shit you not, she wrote down the name of the shady corporation, and then the worker was like, and it's fishy. And she writes down fishy on her notebook.
I'm so sad that he gave her the name of the, like, the first corporation, not the, like, overhead corporation, because the overhead corporation is called Glockenspiel Industries, and I would have paid good money to watch that woman try to spell Glockenspiel.
It's just a weird fucking movie. Like, why do some characters have vaguely Slavic accents, some have British accents, and some have American accents?
Why in this white-ass country is the wedding planner who's coming in to give them the most traditional wedding that the country's ever seen clearly not from this country?
How, like, she would step on a carpet of South African flowers, and, like, that sounds great. Like, South African flowers are incredible. If you've ever seen, like, a pink Duchess peony. Anyway, this is not Aldovian, though. Like, surely you have Aldovian flowers. It's probably some, like, beautiful white mountain flowers somewhere. Like, she could be stepping on a carpet of those.
Right, like, Meghan Markle had all of the, like, regional flowers of the UK sewn, embroidered into her dress. Even in the fucking Princess Diaries, everything has to do with Genovian pears. Like, it's not hard to be like, this is a national thing. And they,
I mean, I
even
think this returns us to the closed network that is Aldovia, that, like, five people live in this country. Four of them live in the palace. And
do you think the royal family of Aldovia is the royal family just by virtue of them being the last remaining Aldovians? Like, everyone else is from somewhere else because it's a tax haven or whatever.
Mm. And that explains all the accents.
Yeah. Yes, it does explain all the accents and, like, the surprising racial diversity of, like, a tiny-ass country in the middle of the mountains that apparently has nothing but Christmas to recommend it.
We're agreed that the national flower of Aldovia would be a poinsettia, right?
Oh, God.
It would, which does not make sense, but yes, it would be.
Or it would be, like, holly and ivy or something.
Yes, it would. I mean, this theory, like, explains Aldovia better than anything I have ever heard. That it's like a guest worker economy and everybody comes in, they're seasonal workers to work at Christmas, and during the summer it's just like a nightmareville where it's just the royal family living inside the palace staring at each other and contemplating their own mortality. Mm-hmm. I believe that.
Yeah, that seems right. It explains why Amber didn't feel the need to be there the rest of the year. She was like, if it's not Christmas, what's even the fucking point?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they're like, summer in Aldovia are the dark times. We don't talk about the dark times.
So one thing that kind of has nothing really to do with this movie, but when they were doing all the wedding planning scenes, you know, Amber is supposed to evoke this, like, ordinary bride who's being pressured by the wedding industry and by wedding tradition and by all of this, and it's all coming down on her head, and she's just has no choice but to go along with it because she's being bullied by the horrible wedding industry and wedding tradition, and finally she learns to put her foot down and stand up for herself. So that kind of storyline really hits differently in 2020 when we're increasingly seeing brides just have no difficulty standing up for themselves at all. And like wedding workers who, let's be real, the wedding industry, quote unquote, is not so much an industry as a bunch of small businesses. It's one of the last remaining industries that is almost completely made up of small local businesses that hire locally, who are predominantly woman-owned, and who are being forced to work because they have no other income for people who are still having 200 plus unmasked weddings. So it really hits differently. I think it says something about the average American bride that Netflix decided that this is a universally relatable struggle. When it turns out, when the chips come down, it's the exact opposite. No one, the wedding industry has no real power except to go along with it.
It just shows you that the uprising of the proletariat is coming soon to Aldovia, but not soon enough.
That's the Christmas Prince 4.
The Rise of the Proletariat? That movie. Sign me up. Take all my money. Let's go.
Can we talk about how, the tabloid reporters appear to be relentless and work around the clock, and there are more of them than we've seen for workers of every other industry? Why are there so many tabloid reporters in a tiny-ass country?
Once again, there are more... Okay, first of all, the airport in this movie, the Aldovian airport, which is apparently the only airport in the country, looks like a regional airport in Kansas. It maybe gets 4 flights. How in the world do they have, a mob of 30 paparazzi? I mean, maybe the explanation is that if Christmas is the primary industry of Aldovia, the secondary industry is paparazzi. Right.
Especially because it's
like the marketing engine.
It's sort of implied that they weren't there for her, but they happened to notice and recognize her and then swarmed. And you're like, are there just paparazzi chilling at the airport at Aldovia? Well, although if we're saying that only really important and wealthy billionaires go to this country, maybe there are reporters who are just paid to chill at the exit. And anytime anyone comes in, they can then report and be Angelina Jolie just came to make a bank deposit in Aldovia.
It really weirdly underlines how bad of a job they did at making this an appealing royal fantasy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, lots of people would love to marry into European royalty. It's a common daydream. Mm-hmm. But they've offered nothing about that aspirational dream other than paparazzi tagging you everywhere. And I don't know, going tobogganing? Ordinary people go tobogganing.
Right.
They just offer nothing about Aldovia to make, a little girl say, I want to be queen of that country.
Right. Even her wedding doesn't seem, a princessy wedding because she fights so hard to make it her own. So you don't even have that moment of she gets to wear fancy jewels and she gets this big party. It just kind of looks like any other wedding, the wedding photo when they make this big deal of her having to wear the royal jewels. And then it's the tackiest, most plastic looking Claire's necklace you've ever seen. I want a scene where the queen takes her down into the dungeon and shows her the royal jewels and there's just fucking diamonds everywhere. If you're gonna give me a princess fantasy, give me the princess fantasy.
Right? But there's no meat to this daydream. People want to watch princess movies because they want to imagine themselves as a princess, and there's adoring crowds and there's lots of ball gowns. Where are the fucking ball gowns? You can just rent one from Rent the Runway for $400. There's no excuse.
It's the night before Christmas, if you celebrate. And Christmas is a time where I like to sit around a fire and talk to my family about all the things that have happened over the year that made me happy. You know what's made me happy this year is our people on Patreon. Seriously, I mean this. I'm not even being glib or sarcastic or whatever. Y'all are great, and you've been so supportive in this weird journey we've been on together. So for one, I think actually it's going to be, the final time for 2020. Thanks so much to our patrons on Patreon, and especially our romantic leads, who are Bob, Esther, Ian, and Trey. Thank you so much.
Thank you, guys. And thank you to all of our patrons. As always, you can choose to support us by going to patreon.com/romcomkilljoys as well. You can also check out our merch shop and get yourself some Romcom Killjoys swag. We've got a couple new things in honor of the Christmas season up there if you want to check it out. That's romcomkilljoys.threadless.com. And like us on our social media and let us know what you thought of this episode, because we love to hear from you. This has been a long year. And a tough year, but this podcast has been so much fun, and we've loved connecting with all of you through it. So thank you. Okay, so this trash fire, what a way to go out for 2020, talking about this hell movie. Let's provide some antidotes to get away from this disaster. Janelle, what have you got for us this week?
So I think one of the things that this movie, Christmas Prince 2, The Royal Wedding, got me into thinking about was the Megxit controversy with Prince Harry and Meghan Markle leaving their senior positions as part of the British royal family. And one of the articles that I read about it that really struck me as particularly insightful was one in the New Yorker. It's called Prince Harry and Meghan Markle's Fractured Fairy Tale by Rebecca Mead. And the article is a really good rundown of all of the challenges that contemporary royals face and that Meghan Markle specifically faced as a Black woman, Canadian by birth, but American by kind of profession. Moving into this royal family tradition and why it didn't work for them. But it also kind of parallels their journey with the previous Duke and Duchess of Sussex, the only previous Duke and Duchess of Sussex of England, and their similar journey to leave the royal family and take their place among the commoners. It was a really interesting article. That's Prince Harry and Meghan Markle's Fractured Fairy Tale in The New Yorker, written by Rebecca Mead. And the second and final thing I want to say, just because everybody I think should go out on this note, whether or not you celebrate Christmas, I think you'll get a big kick out of a YouTube video that I stumbled upon this morning by virtue of my brilliant little brother. It's called The Case Against Santa Denialism. It's from a YouTuber called Sisyphus55. And the video is a brilliant dissection of of Western philosophy, and they use it in a way to kind of talk about playground discussions of Santa and denying Santa and why denying Santa in 2020 is maybe not the right thing to do, and that we should embrace hope and magic and joy this year, and it's worth watching. That's The Case Against Santa Denialism on YouTube.
Alice, do you have any antidotes for us this week?
No antidotes, just, be problematic, everyone. That's your assignments this week. Just, don't improve yourselves, don't read any long-form articles, just be real problematic, read lots of scurrilous, unfounded gossip about people who don't deserve it, consume a bodice ripper that's not gender critical, go enjoy a canceled YouTuber, just be real problematic, everyone. Happy Christmas.
Well, I've got a few antidotes. If you are trying to improve upon yourself, I'm not sure that these will be helpful, but they'll certainly entertain you for a brief period of time. The first is go read the 2020 Hater's Guide to the Williams-Sonoma Catalog. The Hater's Guide is an article that comes out every year written by a columnist named Drew McGarry, which is possibly my favorite part of the Christmas season these days. He goes through the Williams-Sonoma catalog and just rips apart the most ridiculous things in it. There's a lot of things that are priced prohibitively, I would say, and are designed for a very particular kind of lifestyle. And reading this guy just rip into the upper class expectations of this catalog is so funny. They're so well written. I like hurt myself laughing every year. And it came out just a few days ago, so go check out the 2020 Hater's Guide. And if you haven't read the previous ones, there's at least five or six others. Just go down the list and read them all, because they're great. It'll really get you into the holiday spirit. If you're looking for a Netflix thing to watch that is Christmassy and, you know, is still not maybe fine art, but that is more enjoyable than the Christmas Prince movies, that maybe has a slightly more intact plot, and that really does actually leave you with the sort of the joy and the fantasy of Christmas magic at the end of it, I would suggest watching the series Dash and Lily. It's this really cute series. It's based on a book that is about these two high schoolers in New York City. They really should be college kids. There's a couple of times where you're like, this doesn't make sense if they're 17, but look past that. But it's about a couple of high schoolers in New York City who start leaving notes for each other, and they haven't met. And it takes them all around the city at Christmas time as they sort of explore what things the other one likes about the city and likes about the season and doesn't like about the season. And it's just fun. It's very dear at the end. You know, there's like a big sort of magical happy ending. And throughout it, it's just an enjoyable ride that is less problematic and confusing than the Christmas Prince movies. But I mean, still problematic. Don't worry. Like, they do send a 17-year-old to a club and get her drunk in the middle of the day at a diner. So like, it's not perfect. But it is fun, and you do walk away with that kind of, like, oh, the magic of Christmas feel that I just did not get from The Royal Wedding. So that would be a better option if you're looking for some easy entertainment.
I mean, I think I speak for all of us, but specifically Alice, when I say that, you know, what's that phrase from fucking Christmas that I'm for Christmas? So something to all and to all a good night.
What's that phrase from something to Christmas?
I believe it's Merry Christmas, you animals.
Merry Christmas. That's to it, all Alice. And to all a good night, Janelle.
I say Merry Christmas, you filthy animals, and be problematic, everyone.
Thank you for listening to the Rom-Com Killjoys podcast. If you liked what you heard, be sure to follow us on Facebook and Instagram.
If you'd like to support us further, you can become a patron at patreon.com/romcomkilljoys.
Our theme song is Lady Slut Hitchhike Love by the band A Giant Dog, and the song you're listening to now is a cover of Baby Love by Colin Langaness.
Remember, Killjoys, don't let anyone kill your joy.
Not a rom-com. Not us.
Not anyone.
See you next time.
Instead of breaking up, let's start some kissing and making up.